the foundations, but they've drifted a little off center. Actually, therefore, all the skills were worshipped. Every temple and church was a spiritual revelation. The different flutes and columns of Greek temples were designed to meet the requirements of the deities represented. No building was simply built from a general plan. Every building had to be a complete expression of the purpose for which it was intended. It had to be a morality in stone, a revelation in marble, and a vast structure to the glory of God. So the result is the buildings were a little better done, I think, than they are now. At least there was a great pride and dedication. These builders were worshiping God, loving God, by the skills of their hands. The Essenes of the Holy Land, to which order it is sometimes believed that Jesus belonged. The Essenes were a group of mystics, and they worshiped God by service. When they wanted to pray, they may have had a few words of prayer, and then they went out and built young people a home so they could start out in life, and didn't charge them anything for it. To build houses for young people starting out was their way of expressing their love of God. Now, it may seem a little complicated, but this type of affection for things has a great deal of integrity in it, a great deal of meaning, a great deal of value. So everything was just as practical as you would want it today. Everything was just as efficient, but it was ensouled. There was something behind it that you didn't have to make rules and didn't have to go through all the lockers every day to find if someone had some cocaine in there. These rules, first of all, dedicated the workmen to their work. It made their work a glory. No one worked just for money, nor worked for fame, but to express his own inner convictions. Every conscientious builder was building for the greater glory of God and the greater good of mankind. This type of thinking was the under part, and this is where it seems to me that the love factor is tremendously important, because we have so little evidence of it in any of the vast institutions that we are building today. We are building with credits, we are building with bond issues, we are paying fabulous sums for efficient management, much of which lands in jail in the end. We do all kinds of things. We do things that are destructive simply because they are profitable. We endanger the civilization to which we belong for a few dishonest dollars, and never the thought comes to mind about it at all. And in such cases as this, the love factor, which is supposed to warm up and make things beautiful, is completely overlooked. We continue to insist that love is a very personal emotion, and that this love emotion is very physical, and maybe a little bit parental, but for the most part indulgent, and there is no moral responsibility, no sacredness in the affections which we try to practice or maintain. Which brings us to the seventh of the divisions, and that is love of family. This is the final chain, a link in the chain that binds the world to the pinnacles of Olympus. Family, to the ancients and to most people, was a microcosm. That is, it was the little universe. It was the little world over which a little group of people, alchemists, so to speak, were attempting to perfect the chemistry of human relationship. Home was the beginning and first great challenge of a cooperative society. And home became very important way, way back in China, when there were records and of the keeping of the various family records and so forth for nearly 2,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. The whole Chinese system of family was very simple. Family was a little diagram, just a little thing you could put on paper, a symbol. But it was the perfect symbol of the largest nation that exists, the largest continent that exists, and the whole planet. Because all the values in life that are important are based upon the integrities of human relationships. And these integrities include friendships and family memberships. The individual who cheats his friend is a little more guilty than the individual who cheats his enemy, but both are equally wrong. The Chinese were quite convinced that there should never be in this world a family to which God could not come in for dinner if he happened to be going by. The unseen guest was reality, integrity, and value. And these people tried in their best way to prove this, especially through the teachings of Confucius and Mencius. They taught very, very simply, but very directly, the importance of the family relationships. One thing they pointed out, too, which was very important, and that is that each individual in a family has certain inalienable rights, just as every tree in the valley has inalienable rights. The family is a group of people uniting by mutual agreement, living together because they want to be living together. But each one has the dignity of a person. Each one has the right to be treated as a person and to treat all others as a person. According to Confucius, there was never a time in which a discord between parent and child was right. There was never a time when the courtesies that are in public should not be practiced in private. If the gentleman opens the chair or moves the chair so the lady can sit down in the restaurant, he should do the same thing at home. If he wears a little better clothes when he comes to dinner, he should do the same thing at home. If he is kind and gentle to other people, if he allows his friends to go through the door before him, the same should be done in his home. His home should be as courteous, kindly, cooperative, and understanding, with proper respect for the rights, integrities, and convictions of every member. Now, it would sound as though this might end in chaos, but it would end in chaos except for one thing. If all do it, it is a perfect cosmos. It is everything living itself in harmony with all other life. And then the entire problem of Chinese culture, this is very strongly emphasized, that after all, regardless of race, nation, or any other factor, humanity is a family. It is one family that has been artificially divided by false instruction, has been isolated by localities, has been tyrannized by tyrants and dictators, has fallen under the abuses of slavery and every other type of evil. But in the universe of things, love of God means to straighten this out. We cannot love God as long as we neglect the inalienable rights of our neighbors. We cannot build a good world while we try with sword and bomb to dominate the patterns, beliefs, and convictions of our neighbors. If tyranny ends in one area, it will end all over, because tyranny can only feed on tyranny. Tolerance gradually takes over, but only if tolerance is established according to the will of God. Also, we find in this family problem a great deal of lack of insights. People do not know how to raise a family. They do not know what to compromise and what not to compromise. They are constantly thinking of their own place in the family, when the answer really is that they must find the family place in their own hearts. Until they do this, there is no solution. Now, all of these were therefore called phases of love. Phases of love that extend all the way from the dramatization of the divine plan to a little romance on the back porch. It is all part of the same thing. But love, primarily, is a universal energy, and it cannot be blocked into small patterns. There cannot be any fulfillment in love if it is dominated entirely by physical considerations. Love is not basically physical. But the physical world is a place where love can reveal itself in a magnificent way. Self-sacrifice, dedication to duty, life and love that go beyond the grave. All of these things are dedications and proofs, but they are meaningless unless the individuals involved have these convictions within themselves. So we can say, perhaps, in generally speaking, that all we really need now is a universe ruled by love. What we don't realize is that's what we've got, but we have perverted it. We have denied it. We have built another world on illusions that have no substance in ethics or integrities. And yet there isn't a single blade of grass that grows or a single tree on a hillside that cannot help us to find the truth if we want it. The trouble is, most people, in all of their activities, are not concerned so much with truth as they are with profit. They are constantly considering the advancement of their own causes. Therefore, we have the curious phenomena of selfish love. Well, selfish love has something about it that's very reminding of hate, because selfish love ends in hate. It ends in the perversion and destruction of everything that is useful, valuable, or necessary in life. Now, we're all trying to do something a little better with ourselves these days, and we talk a great deal of mysticism. There are many interesting and some very valuable writings appearing on this subject, and there is a very important group of books going back to Neoplatonism and the Pythagorean school. All of these things are pointing out the importance of the individual unfolding the resources of himself, the individual to become part of a program or a plan bigger than his ordinary dedications. Therefore, they have this problem of love coming into it. We find that most meditational exercises have very little value unless the individual is sincere. Now, sincerity is not just simply a belief that they will work. Sincerity is also the motive for which it is undertaken. The individual whose primary interest is to try and find a way to perfect his own nature labors in vain. He must have a dedication. Unless he loves something bigger than himself, his intellectual efforts are more or less frustrated. We have great educational institutions, universities worldwide, that are failing because they're all mind and no heart, because they're perpetuating all kinds of useful information without edifying the believer to the point where he will not pervert knowledge. As long as he is not taught to be honorable, no amount of skill can help him to protect his civilization. Civilization is built upon integrities. It is built upon values. It is built upon respects. It is built upon the basic fact that people like Schweitzer, Albert Schweitzer, gave a lifetime to helping people, and that lifetime has gone much further in the perfection of his own nature than any system of esoteric disciplines could possibly go. To go out and do it, to prove conclusively love of God by loving a job that helps others, is probably one of the best ways we have of perfecting the world and the life to which we are dedicated. Now, young people growing up need to be taught this. They need to be taught it not in a sloppy way, not in a sentimental type of thing. They need to be taught it as a great, strong, powerful fact. We are all greatly addicted to facts. We like to believe that what we believe is solid, firm, and sound. And the result of that is, at the present time, we are believing on the shakiest foundation in history. Nothing that we claim to believe has been properly researched, properly examined, properly thought through. And as a result of that, we are simply under the hypnosis of what we term progress. Now, progress is a fine thing, but progress, again, has to be loved. A love of progress is in most people. They just glorify the idea that next year the cars will be a little better, and that the television programs will be worth watching. This is a hope which may or may not be fulfilled. But people believe in progress. They worship it. They can think of nothing but a new wheel on the computer. They know now that we live in the best world that has ever been because we are developing nuclear material. We know that we are the very acme of perfection when we landed a man on the moon. All of this is a worship of what? A worship of comparative non-essentials. All the time that we have been building this machinery, all the time we've been raising the taxes to pay for it, all the time we have had more expensive governments, more expensive sciences than ever before in history, the individual has not found very much love of progress. Because love would make him dedicate progress. It would make him realize that progress is nothing unless it goes inside of people and makes them live better, makes them more understanding, and gives them a reason to worship the integrities of progress. It's all right to say this machine is remarkable, but the next question is it being used with an understanding of the purpose of life? Is the man who is using it enlightened, or is he merely working for a salary? If everything is for salaries and everything is for mechanics, the world will fall apart. It will fall apart because friendship, faith, integrities, love, fraternal realizations, these are the glue that hold the world together. And unless we do something to do this, we're just going to have one nuclear accident after another, because nobody really has their heart in it. They want progress, but they do not realize that progress is an incline upward. And all progress must ascend. There must be a little less of error, a little more of truth, a little more of courage and strength. Unless these values are preserved, progress is a joke. Because tomorrow we'll have something else. When Einstein made his theory, everyone said he was the world wonder. Since that time, another group of scientists have taken him apart. And this is the thing that happens. Because of one central point, which incidentally Einstein is said to have made this statement, that he wished more than anything else in the whole world that he could believe in God. Well, it isn't that hard if you really want to work at it. But it's a fact that the materialistic culture, materialistic values, put all labors on the basis of physical policy. The individual works because he is told that this is the best way to do. What he is doing, he never questions, because if he does, he loses the job anyway. But the mere fact of the problem is very definite, that all this progress, all this tremendous pressure, which is turning the world into a mass of rascals, has as its ending only chaos. Because every step of progress has to be ensouled, if it is to accomplish anything worth doing. Unless it has value of it, unless the individual who is doing it has a motive above his paycheck, we are building a civilization that could sometimes go down along with the old Atlantis and the great Lemurian ages that have gone before. Everything has to have a tie to humanity, to love for people, for recognition of our responsibilities to help rather than to hinder. Of course, nature and God have their own way of doing some of these things, and it is noticeable that in recent years particularly, a great many private citizens or small groups suffering from the inclemencies of the modern temperatures have attempted to do something. They have taken up jobs of cleaning out problems. They have taken out jobs of curbing crime and have helping to take care of the impoverished immigrants. They are working on problems. And those are the people who are beginning to show that they are learning and that the lesson that they are learning is part of the great school. For among other points of interest is that the universal life has established a system of education uniquely its own. And this education, again, is a very wonderful thing. because it means that no matter how many mistakes we make and how long we make them, ultimately the mistakes will correct themselves. We will become too weary with suffering unnecessarily. We will discover that the policies that we are forming are short range, that they're unfair, and that they're unreasonable. And little by little, common sense is taking over. And common sense, in a certain measure at least, seems to be the power of God working in the human soul. Common sense is something that tells us what the books don't tell us. And they also, the common sense also tells us that there are solutions. And the investigation of social conditions in search of a solution is becoming more interesting to many, many people. So, but all around, it all sums up in the one compound of love. Everything should move from this angle, from this point, from this premise, that we are here to get along together in one of the most beautiful regions that we have ever heard of. A nice little neat planet that can take good care of us if we do not exploit it. But if we keep on foreclosing mortgages on the planet, we're going to get in trouble. If we keep on exploiting and never replacing, if we keep on thinking of the planet as a magnificent bowl full of everything we want that will remain full forever like the magic pitcher of the Greeks, we will someday wake up in terrible problems. Because after all, according to the Neoplatonists, the planet is a person. The planet is a living thing. If it wasn't a living thing, it couldn't support life. And every root that goes down into it is being fed by some kind of a wonderful living reality. And the planet has temperaments. Many planets do. It has temper fits. And it has just cause for them. In fact, there's no reason why it shouldn't be very much offended and very much disgusted with its progeny, because the world is treating the planet very badly. Now, up somewhere in the higher echelons of things, you can't treat planets badly and get away with it any more than you can treat your neighbor. All of these things are part of what Buddha called a great commonwealth, a common source of good for all. And the exploitation of any of these values ultimately will result in trouble. And we are beginning to have these troubles in many different areas. Many of our new discoveries, our greatest advancements and so on, are reacting unfavorably upon ourselves. We are not solving anything. We have no real interest in solving. So it's possibly time for us to go back to what you might term the classical educational theory, namely that young people starting out in life went usually, finally, to the head of the village, the archon, or whoever was the master mayor of the village, and said he would, and would say he wanted to go to school. He wanted to attend one of the better schools. Now, their schools in those days, of course, were not like the public schools of today. The school was usually in the temple. And before you could join it, you had to apply, and an officer was appointed to check your application. So he would come to the town where you were brought up, and he would talk to the people there. Had you ever been in trouble? Had you ever cheated anybody? Had you ever been unkind or cruel? Did you ever neglect a civic duty? Were you in trouble with your parents? Where all these different things were weighed. And unless you had a certain degree of integrity, you were not acceptable. And you could, however, make a valiant effort and apply again later. But unless you had a basically good reputation to start with, it was not assumed that it was safe to give you any more. After you had been accepted into this system and were educated, you went into the temple schools. Now, the temple schools are the places where every art and science we know today had their beginnings. Here was mathematics, here was science, here was medicine, here was law. Here was everything of the great university, but it was under the leadership of the national religion. which in the case of Greeks or Egypts, we know that we had Egypt, we know what these religions were. After you had gone to a certain degree in this, you took the oath that you would never use this knowledge to discredit or damage any living thing. That you would never, if you took the medical degree and took the Asclepian oath, you would never refuse to serve the patient because he was poor. And that all times, every physician had his daily worship at the altar of the God of healing. When in Rome, they weren't quite so good over there, but in Rome, when they did secularized medicine and said that the doctor didn't have to be educated in a temple or take an Asclepian oath, within 10 years, they had to put up laws for medical malpractice. It was the religion that held it straight, where the individual knew that every other physician knew the oath he had taken, and most of his patients did also. It was less easy to forget the integrities to which he was dedicated. And the same in the temple of law. Every lawyer took his oath before the altar of his God. Integrity had to come first. Now, we've gone a long way since then, and of course ages have passed, and the evidence is beginning to accumulate that unless we get some kind of a love above a pocketbook, we're going to be in trouble. We are going to be in trouble until the soul rules the body. We are going to be in trouble until the life within us dominates the policies of our outer daily existence. As long as we can break the rules of God, we will never be successful in keeping the codes necessary for the preservation of human society. Now, of course, this isn't all bad, because actually, if we don't do it right and we get into serious trouble, we will learn. But we will learn the hard way. We will learn through privation and loss and pain. We will lose the respect of our own families. We will lose the confidence of the world in which we live. Therefore, it isn't hardly worthwhile for us to take the chance, as we do now face those chances with nuclear fission. The situation in Russia recently is a strong warning that we cannot afford to take the chance of allowing strength to fall into the keeping of those who have not been dedicated to the greater good of all humanity. We have to have dedications, and dedications come from love. We are dedicated to the happiness of those around us because we love them. We are dedicated to our family because we love it. We want to do well for our children because we love them. We want to have a close family life because we all love each other in that little small group. But by the time maturity is reached, this little love nest is often broken asunder. Broken, ruined, and wrecked by the gradual exploitation of society by people who have forgotten the integrities of basic truths. So we have to work every day a little bit on this very serious and very necessary matter. And I think love is very good in this sense, that it helps us not to be critical of others. Even if they're wrong, we can still love them even though they are wrong. But we do not have to copy their mistake. We can also do what we can to help people in every field. It isn't that we have to just sit back and suffer the aloneness of virtue. We're all involved in things. But one point is very necessary, and they're beginning to discover it. The Chinese have discovered it when they started to reopen the temples of Confucius and Mencius. It is being found throughout the world. And even Napoleon Bonaparte, in his worst moment, said that without religion, no nation could be civilized. So we are now in the face of a need for a great world civilization. And the only power strong enough to make it and sustain it is love. A love that has been in us and with us since the dawn. A love that can keep right on making things better for us. But we have to rise to the realization that emotions like love are not just superficial things. They're not just happiness for this and happiness for that. Behind it all, in the pattern of divine love, as it was known in Egypt and among the Greeks and later among the Asiatic mystics, love was a responsibility that we love truth enough to obey its rules, that we love God enough to love the other creatures He has fashioned, and that we love our neighbor enough not to be influenced by superficial considerations. Neither race, nor color, nor creed should interfere with the universality of man's primary respect for life, and that in serving life itself, we become the faithful stewards in the sanctuaries of truth. The world is finally a temple. We are its priests. And unless we practice its virtues, the temple rapidly descends to become a fraudulent institution. The whole theory is clear and simple, and I think it's rather strong and useful. The theory that love is to help things to grow, to make them greater and better for their own good and for the common good. And that when the Lord so loved the world that He gave to it His only begotten Son, it is up to us now to know and realize and understand that that sacrifice was not in vain, and that the love of God for man can be equaled, though, by the love of man for God. And when this balance is reached, our world will be a much happier and more livable place, and we'll all have time to be our better selves without persecution, misery, or suffering. So it's always a good thing to remember these levels of love, because they do help us to plan our own lives and realize that love is the common denominator of practically everything that is useful in existence. Well, I guess that's it. But I'd like to also wish, on this festive occasion, Happy Mother's Day, because that is really the fountain and source of our hope, that this will ultimately prove that we will all be mothers and fathers of each other, and will all be parents of a better world than we have ever known. We are very grateful to the mothers who have given us being, and we are very grateful to the wise parents who have given us well-being. And we are very, very grateful to God for having given us mothers, parents, and a beautiful world.